STR podcasts are made possible through the generous donations of our listeners. To support STR today, go to str.org and click on Donate in the upper right-hand corner.
This is Brett Kunkel, and you're listening to the Bulletproof Podcast. I know. I've let too much time go by between my last podcast and this one, but I do appreciate some of the messages on Facebook, some of the tweets that I've gotten, even someone giving me a little nudge at the Rethink conference this fall, telling me, "Hey, Brett, when's the next podcast?" So anyway, I need that pressure. I work best under pressure. So keep it up. But all right, time to get back on the podcasting horse here. And so today I've got a special treat for you. I was looking through some old files and discovered a phone call that I have that I recorded that I think you'll be interested in hearing. And so let me explain this to you, and then I'll play part of the phone call for this podcast, and then I'll create a part two because it's about a 50-minute phone call. So I'm sure if you listen to this podcast for any amount of time or follow kind of what we do at Standard Reason, you know about the Utah and Berkeley mission trips that we take students on. And so we work with youth groups and college groups and Christian high schools, and we get the teaching and the training in apologetics and theology out of the classroom and into real life. And we take students on these trips. And of course, when we go on the Berkeley trip, we're focusing on training students in apologetics and philosophy and how to think well. And so we bring in atheists. And this is actually from a few years back, working with a group here in Southern California. We took them to Berkeley, and this was their first Berkeley mission trip. And one of the atheists that we brought in to challenge the students was he's an atheist named Richard Carrier, and he's a guy that we have come in periodically to address the students. And Richard is a historian, did his PhD in, I believe, his ancient history, and he's a well-known skeptic, atheist. Some refer to him as an internet infidel. But anyway, so we have Richard come in and challenge the students, and we particularly had him come in and challenge the students on Jesus's existence, and we got into issues of historicity and the resurrection and kind of all over the place. And now when we have – and so the students, what they get to do is they get to interact with this guy, and they get to, you know, hear his arguments and then respond, and it's great – kind of live fire practice for them, and it really challenges them, and it's motivating for them to then really know their stuff, because here they are being challenged by this atheist who he certainly has lots of arguments that he throws their way. So it was a really good challenge. And of course, I'm a generalist. I am not a specialist, and so some of these issues definitely get deep for me. And so since we brought Carrier in, I thought, hey, it would be great to actually get a Christian historian to debrief the students, because what we always do after these kind of encounters is we spend significant time debriefing, because we don't want them to just be challenged and then kind of leave some of these questions kind of hanging in the air. But we want to answer the challenges, and we want them to see that we don't have to be afraid of these challenges, that Christianity can stand up to these challenges. And so we'll debrief, and we'll kind of pick apart the arguments, and we'll kind of narrate the argument, show students kind of what the arguments were and what the challenges were and how they're faulty and that kind of thing. So we do these debriefs. And so I decided to surprise this particular group with a debrief with a professional historian, a Christian historian, a friend of mine, Mike Lacona. And I'm sure probably most of you know who Mike is. He's a expert on the resurrection. He's a fantastic historian. He's a great man. He's a godly man. He has a heart for the Lord. I just love Mike. and just have the privilege of knowing him. And so was able to arrange a phone call for him to help debrief our group. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to play for you the first half of that phone call, and then in the next podcast, we'll play the second half. And I think there's some value in this. Number one, you get to hear students. These are college students. You get to hear them asking questions, questions that you won't hear most Christian college students ask. Now, why are they asking these questions? Because they just were in a situation where they were being challenged. They were being provoked. These questions are provoked by a skeptic. And so I want you to see the value in challenging our young people and putting them in situations where they're going to be made uncomfortable. And the real value in making them uncomfortable is that it provokes these questions. It creates this internal motivation to seek the answers. So now I'm not just handing them a book and saying, here, read this. I'm not saying, here, go listen to this lecture or listen to me teach. But now the students are saying, hey, feed me. Hey, give me more of the truth. And there's this internal motivation, and I think you get, you know, that kind of comes out, certainly comes out on these trips. We see students on their own free time studying because they've been challenged. But then it's also, I think you see one of the other values here is introducing them to good Christian thinkers and helping them to see that there are smart, brilliant, intelligent Christians who love Christ, who are passionate and who are on our side and who are great defenders of the faith. And so it was just a pleasure to introduce these students to Mike Lycona as one of our, you know, one of our smart guys, one of our great defenders. And so now we're going to get a little deep. We'll get deep into some of the historical issues. So I think you'll find value in that as well. Mike is an incredible scholar and expert. So sit back and enjoy the first half of this phone call with Mike Lycona.
Okay,
you know,
yeah, he knows. Of course, he knows.
This is really a surprise
for you guys.
Can you hear me?
Okay, call it.
No,
yeah.
That's awesome.
Can we get higher volume?
What are we doing? We're calling who?
Mike Lycona.
Mike Lycona.
Okay.
Hey, Mike, it's Brett.
Hey, Brett, how are you doing?
Good, good. Can you hear me well?
I can.
Okay, great, great. Hey, thanks for taking some time out to talk with us. You got a group of college students here that are listening in on our phone call here. Yeah, you guys...
Okay.
You guys
hey, Mike.
Good morning, everyone. Good to spend a few moments with you.
Yeah, we just... We just spent some time with – we spent about an hour and a half with Richard Carrier, and he was talking to us about the resurrection and some other historical issues. And so we've got some questions that have arisen from our time with him that you we thought, you know, we'd go to another historian to get some more information from. So I'm going to let some of these students throw out some questions, and then we'll sit here and listen to you answer them. And I know we have about 25 minutes with you, correct?
Okay, yeah, that's about right. Let me ask you this. I'm just curious what kind of venue you guys were just at. Did Carrier just come to speak to a few of you, or did you go to something at which he was speaking?
No, he came. We arranged to have him come speak to just our group.
Like 10 of us.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's been, 5 years since I debated Carrier and really haven't kept up with the stuff, but I'll try the best I can and tell you. Admit if I don't have an answer ready at hand.
Okay. What's yes? Yeah, go ahead, Gianni.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Don't bother with that.
Good, stuff. How are you?
Hey, Richard Carrier was talking about how 1 Peter and 2 Peter, and he talked about 1 Thessalonians and 2 Thessalonians too, and he talked about how it's not very debated among scholars. Well, I mean, he might have said that, but... He said that 1 Peter and 1 Thessalonians were actually written by the apostles, Peter and 1 Peter and Thessalonians being Paul. But then he said during the second book of each of those, 2 Peter and 2 Thessalonians, that from the literary devices used and other reasons, that they weren't actually written by those apostles. I was wondering if you had reasons why they were written by those apostles.
Okay. I would say that Richard is correct that many, if not most scholars, almost all scholars believe that Paul wrote 1 Thessalonians. And I would say that at least many, probably most, believe that Peter wrote 1 Peter. And when I say many or most, I'm talking about all scholars. You know, I'm talking about atheists and agnostics and Jews and Christians, liberal Christians, conservative Christians, radical Christians like those who would call themselves Christians who are members of the Jesus Seminar. So I'm talking about the whole gamut here, okay, just to be clear. Okay. Now, when it comes to 2 Thessalonians, I would say that I don't know the actual figure, but there's a large number of scholars who believe that Paul wrote 2 Thessalonians. 2 Peter is hotly disputed, and I would say the majority of scholars, and again, we're including skeptical ones here, atheist ones, etc., they reject 2 Peter as being written, having been written by Peter. At this point, I haven't spent a lot of time on the different arguments for why this is the case, but I know that I have spent some time with Ephesians, which is hotly disputed. And in fact, I would say that the majority of scholars today don't accept Ephesians as being Pauline. But the reason they give for that are stylistic reasons. They say that when you look at Paul's other undisputed letters, that would be like Romans, 1st, 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Philippians, Philemon, 1st Thessalonians. When you look at those, the style, the grammar that's used is different. Some of the words that are used are different than what Paul uses in these other letters. I don't find those arguments very persuasive, and let me give you a couple of reasons why. Number one is, several years ago, I was reading through Paul's letters, his undisputed letters, and his prison epistles. His prison epistles would be Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and Philemon. I was reading through them 30 times in Greek, and I remember reading in commentary on Ephesians how there are all these different stylistic differences that show that Paul did not write. It indicates and suggests that Paul did not write Ephesians. And the number one stylistic difference that was provided is Paul's use of the term heavenly. And in his other letters, he uses the term ouranois. But in Ephesians, he uses the term epouranios. So it's just a slight bit different, but because he uses epouranios in Ephesians and ouranois in all his undisputed letters, they say, based on that, that is the leading stylistic difference on why they contend Ephesians was not written by Paul. Well, as I'm reading through these letters 30 times in Greek, I start to notice in Ephesians that not only does Paul use the term epouranios, but he uses ouranois as well. So I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. I thought that they're pointing out the major differences. He's only using one in Ephesians, and he's using the other. But now I see that he's using both in Ephesians. So that lessens the blow there for sure. But then what I did was I figured, all right, how many times does he use ouranois and epouranios in Ephesians? So I counted them up. And then I thought to myself, well, how does he use these terms in his undisputed letters? And I searched through them, and I found that in 2 Corinthians, which is one of Paul's undisputed letters, hardly anyone disputes that Paul wrote 2 Corinthians, that he uses ouranois and epouranios both in that letter, and he uses them pretty much by the same ratio that he uses them in Ephesians. So if we're going to reject Ephesians as being Pauline, then we also have to reject 2 Corinthians as Pauline for the same reason. But no one would do this because we can pretty much validate, based on the testimony of other ancient authors, that Paul wrote 2 Corinthians. So if that argument fails for 2 Corinthians, it likewise fails for Ephesians. And yet that's the leading argument used against Pauline authorship of Ephesians. So I see that there's a pretty lousy argument that scholars are using to dispel Pauline authorship of some of these letters. let me throw, well, I'll just go from there because I could go on for a while longer. But so, although I can't comment specifically on 2 Peter and 2 Thessalonians, I can say that at least the arguments that are being used against Pauline authorship of Ephesians, and that's probably as disputed as 2 Peter is, or almost, then I find that it's a pretty lousy argument. And I guess you could also throw in that we do know that Paul used scribes at times. And if Paul is talking, Paul probably, well, he very likely knew Greek as well as Hebrew Aramaic, because he's in Acts, he's speaking to the Roman officer. The officer says to him, do you know Greek? He says, yes, and he spoke to him in Greek. So he may have been speaking in Aramaic or a broken Greek, and the scribe was taking it, writing things down. Or Paul, if he's writing duplicate letters, or let's say Peter or something, he's writing a number of letters, and Peter's tired, and he says, hey, you know, hey, can you just take some of the things I said in my message today to the people and put it down and let me read it and sign off for it? So the scribe might have just used different terms, and, you know, we wouldn't have any problems with something like that whatsoever if Peter had final write-off and things like that, so the final okay to. So there's any number of reasons that one could give for why there's different terms, different stylisms. I don't really see those as reasons for dispelling Petrine authorship.
Hey, Mike, we got a second question here. Go ahead, Steve.
What's your take on, like, previous or other Jesus-like stories like Romulus and Cyrus, Deonatus, and Attis?
Specifically, Carrier talked about Romulus as a parallel story. So I think for
yeah, okay, Romulus.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Romulus. That's an interesting one. That's found in a couple of different places. The major source for Romulus in terms of what happened is Plutarch. Plutarch writes around the early part of the 2nd century, 105, 106. He's a Greek writer. He wrote 50 biographies. We have 44 of them today that have survived. Romulus was one of his most famous ones, because Romulus was one of the two legendary founders of Rome. So so here's the story about this, and as Plutarch tells it. Romulus was a good ruler, and pretty much toward the end of his career, after he had founded the city and it was prospering, he went down a bad road, and he started becoming more of a dictator and a bad leader. And there were people complaining, and then one day there was, while the senators and Romulus were out in court, there was this horrible thunderstorm, and people took shelter. It was raining like crazy, it was lightning like crazy, it was dark with the clouds and everything. And when the storm was over, Romulus was gone, and nobody could find him. And so after a couple of days, the people started accusing the senators of killing him. And then a day later, one of the older senators, who was very well-respected, he appears before the people and he says, hey, I was out for a walk this morning, just thinking, and Romulus actually appeared to me. And so he appeared to me and he said, yes, I guess the God saw fit to take me up to be with them. And so I want to encourage all the Romans here to dominate now and to hold firm to your position as Romans at the glorious city. Now, Plutarch says this in a manner as though the senators were doing this to cover their butts because they had actually murdered Romulus, and they conspired to make up this theory in order to protect themselves from the people. So that's not really a good parallel whatsoever for the resurrection of Jesus, I don't think. It has a perfectly natural explanation to it, and that is that they made up the appearances to the Romans in order to cover their own butts. And it was only one person who claimed to have seen it, one of the guys suspected of killing him. There's a similar story like this with another figure named Empedocles, and the same thing could be said there. I don't think that is at all very good if Richard wants to provide that as evidence that people were thinking along these lines.
Yeah. Now, are there any myths that predate Christ that have real close similarities to Christ?
Yeah, I've been looking at these somewhat recently, more than I have in the past. And typically what I'm finding is there are two different kinds. You have your Semitic parallels and you have your Greco-Roman parallels. And most of the time we focus on the Semitic parallels. That would be people like Adonis, Attis, Marduk, Baal, Tammuz, things like that. And it is nearly universally accepted today that there are no Semitic parallels of dying and rising gods that predate Christianity. All of them postdate Christianity. There's one guy out there, his name is T.N.D. Mettinger. He's a senior Swedish scholar. And he has what I believe to be the most recent academic treatment on the subject in a book called The Riddle of Resurrection, I think 2001. And he even admits that nearly the universal consensus of scholars say that they're all rejected. He disagrees with them, and he says that there are at least three, maybe as many as five that predate Christianity, but he defines resurrection differently. He admits that, and in the end, he says that the differences are so profound that there's no way that the Christians would have copied this, and that the Christians actually believed that they had seen Jesus, that he had risen from the dead. It wasn't something like Martin Hengel says, in the great distant past without a dating foot. No, these people actually believed that they saw Jesus, that they were eyewitnesses for it. So it wasn't a legend in that sense. So he says there really are no parallels in that sense of dying and rising God that could have influenced the Christian tradition. That leaves us with the Greco-Roman ones, and as I've looked at these more recently, I think that those are more compelling. I do think that we have a couple of accounts of dying and rising figures in the Greco-Roman world that predate Christianity. But there are some problems with those as well. I found 25 parallels, around 25, but seven are very poor examples. It'd be things like Cleomenes. There was no claim of any post-mortem existence or an appearance. Or Eurydice, who was Phasma, who never returned to Earth. Or Ganymedes, who was like Enoch. There were no appearances afterward. They just disappeared. Or Cleomenes, who was a thug who disappeared from a chest, and there were no appearances. So of those 25 that are commonly cited, seven are very poor examples. And then there were six that were mythical, and they had no actual appearances on Earth anyway, as Asclepius and Alcestis, Bacchus, Heracles, and some others. And then you have six that have very plausible naturalistic explanations that are probably what actually occurred. For example, in the case of Aeneas, some said that the gods took him up, but others said no, his body was lost in a river, because the story of that is, they were involved in a battle one day, two armies, and a bunch of people were killed. And at night, the armies separated. Well, the next day, they went back to claim the bodies, and the body was gone. Aeneas was gone. So some said the gods took him, and others said, no, it fell in the river. So that's not really a good parallel. And Julius Caesar, I mentioned Empedocles, Romulus, and Telemachus and some others. So these are six others that have very plausible naturalistic explanations of what very probably actually occurred, like they were lost in the river or things like that. So really, we only have six finalists. And when you look at those, there may only be one, and that's Trophonius, who it seems like he appeared to a group, and it was related to Apollonius sometime in the first century, but it's not reported until much later. So you look at these, and it sounds like a bunch at first, but when you come down to the end, there aren't too many at all. And you can't really establish that the people actually saw them. They could very well just be myths that occurred over time. Mm. The difference is when we come to the disciples, we can actually establish that they sincerely believed that Jesus had risen and appeared to them, and even an enemy, Paul. So in that kind of case, facts are pretty stubborn things when it comes to these parallels, and that's what excludes many of them as being plausible ways of explaining the appearances of Jesus.
All right, great. Next question.
I just wanted to know your thoughts on the Bayesian theorem.
Carrier used that a couple.
On the what?
Bayesian.
Bayes theorem.
It's Thomas Bayes.
Bayes theorem.
Yeah. He used that several times to say that the probability of miracles was almost non-existent. And I just wanted to know if you felt that was a credible source and just what you thought about it.
I'd have to see how Carrier's using it, but let me just say up front, and I guess you can explain to me how he's using it. But up front, I would say this. You know, my training for my PhD was in philosophy of history and historical methods. And I can tell you that professional historians, not biblical scholars, but professional historians do not use Bayes' theorem in calculating the probability of a historical hypothesis. And the reason being is because background knowledge that is required in order to arrive at a proper probability in that sense is seldom if ever available to us. What historians do in order to arrive at probability when it comes to historical conclusions is they do what are called arguments or inferences to the best explanation. That is, they're going to use a number of criteria, four very important criteria, for assessing a hypothesis, such as, can it account for all the facts? Can it account for all the known facts without forcing them to fit? Do you have to bring in any non-evidence assumptions? Things like that. And the hypothesis, you assess a number of different hypotheses, and the hypothesis that best fulfills those four criteria is regarded as what probably occurred. In history, that is how probability is determined. And like I said, you read philosophers of history like C.B. McCullough, even statisticians like David Bartholomew, who taught at the University of London. They say that just in terms of historical conclusions, you can't use Bayes' theorem. So I don't know how Richard is doing it. Maybe you could tell me a little how he's using it, but I can say that historians pretty much would reject his method because they don't use Bayes' theorem.
Yeah, I think it's something he's actually currently working on. But could you give us those four major criteria again? List those for us, Mike.
Sure. One would be called explanatory scope. That is the ability of a hypothesis to account for the known historical facts.
Okay.
The second is explanatory power. That's the ability of a hypothesis to account for them without forcing them to fit and without the use of deliberate ambiguity. For example, you've got someone like Michael Goulder. He's an agnostic biblical scholar, and he tries to say that, the disciples had some sort of psychological experiences that of the appearances of the risen Jesus. We really don't know what they were. We don't know if they were hallucinations or delusions or mass hysteria or whatever, but it doesn't matter. We just know that they were natural. Well, you haven't shown anything. You've left some general, a great amount of ambiguity there, so that would lack explanatory power. Or if you have to strain, like Carrier does very often in his writings, strain at the interpretation of a biblical text in order to make it tell you what you want to hear, that is lacking explanatory scope because you're going against the plain sense of the report, and Carrier does that all the time in order to get his interpretations. Mm-hmm. The third one would be what's called plausibility, and that does the hypothesis line up with generally accepted beliefs? And when it comes to something like the resurrection, it's going to be very difficult because that's going to be based on largely on worldview. Do you think God exists and acts in the world? And many people say that God doesn't exist and he doesn't act in the world. But that's not, I mean, that's generally accepted, you could say, but there are probably more people who say that God does exist and act in the world. So that would be a generally accepted belief. So I'd say that when we come to something like the resurrection hypothesis or when we're investigating it, as historians, we shouldn't presuppose God's existence. We shouldn't a priori exclude it either, but we should approach it remaining open to the possibility that God may exist and want to raise Jesus and then let the facts speak for themselves. The fourth and final criterion would be less ad hoc. Ad hoc is a Latin term, and it pretty much means that you are using non-evidence assumptions. So, for example, Gerd Ludemann, he's an atheist New Testament scholar. In order for him to explain the resurrection of Jesus, or the appearance to Paul, I should say, he speculates that when Paul was a very little boy, he had a Gentile friend whom he was very close to. And when he grew up, he remembered that Gentile friend, and that motivated him to have the experience of Jesus appearing to him and the call to the Gentiles. Well, of course, there's one major problem with that, and that is there's not a shred of evidence for it. So that's a non-evidence assumption that Ludemann brings in order to explain the appearances. Ludemann or Gulder, I forgot which, but in order to explain the appearance and conversion to Paul and call to preach to the Gentiles. Because Paul's really difficult to explain for skeptics.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a friendly, he's an enemy.
Okay, that's probably a good place to stop. That was the first half of the phone call with Mike Lacona. Pretty cool that college students are sitting around listening to kind of this deep scholarly stuff on Christ, learning how to really go deep in defending Christ, his existence, his resurrection, and dealing with these objections. That's just great stuff. So anyway, at the next podcast, I will play the second half of the phone call. So make sure you don't miss that.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts and radio program are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.